Louisa Worthington, not to put too fine a point on it, had the moral standing of a sewer rat, even if she did have an accent direct from Hampshire and was the widow of a war hero. What was William Mabry thinking? Surely he knew her background. Everyone from Myrtle Grove to Tasmania did. 10 years ago, Louisa Worthington, along with her neighbours Adelaide Nightingale, Pearl Fletcher and young Maggie Albright, had advertised for a part-time husband. An Irish tinker had turned up pretending to be the cousin of Pearl Fletcher, who was then Mrs. Nightingale's housekeeper, and they had shared him. Shared him! All hell had broken loose. The tinker and Mrs. Worthington had fled from the town that very same day and had never been seen again, which was good riddance. But look at her now. Bold as brass didn't begin to describe it. Blonde did, when she disappeared a brunette. Blonde and beautiful and standing right behind the mayor's coffin, not singing but smiling and waving. You could have knocked down with a feather the crowd on the church steps when she'd emerged from the cortege. Bert Lambert's gleaming black Riley had pulled up, the vicar had heaved Mrs. Mabry from the car, and William Mabry had opened the door nearest the curb. A long, elegantly stocking leg had appeared, followed by another. Then a tiny hand had taken the larger hand of Lieutenant Mabry, and what had uncoiled from the car had taken their breath away. "She's dyed her hair," they told each other. Every eye, without fail, had scanned those steps for Adelaide Nightingale, Pearl Fletcher and Maggie Albright. Had those ladies been expecting her? They'd been secretive before, so no one doubted they could be secretive all over again. If they hadn't been expecting her, why were they nowhere to be seen? The answer to that was simple enough. None of them had been expecting her, and none of them were hiding. They were sitting in the pews among the bosoms of their families, waiting to be bored rigid because none had nursed any great love for the mayor. His 25 years were almost certainly going to be accounted for in dreadful detail, and the new vicar's sermons were already famously dull. Neither Pearl Fletcher nor Maggie Albright should have been there anyway, since they were Catholic. No, those ladies were as unprepared for the appearance of Louisa Worthington as the crowd on the steps had been, and their shock, when it occurred, was even greater. Adelaide Nightingale, recently widowed and newly slender as a result, was sandwiched between her children, 11-year-old Freddie and 10-year-old Phyllis. She had remained oblivious, even when Louisa had sidled into the front pew next to Mrs. Mabry and adjusted the widow's voluminous veil in a gesture so intimate that quizzical glances were exchanged as far away as the organ loft. Adelaide knew nothing of any recently arrived Louisa because her eyes had been firmly shut. In prayer, she'd wanted her children to believe, but in sleep was the truth. She'd been startled into knowledge only when someone behind her had gasped, "Good God!" Even from the back, even though a tiny hat sat snugly on a blonde head and not a dark one, she'd known it was Louisa. She'd have known her anywhere, any time, because this was the back of a tormentor, the cause in her life of misery upon misery, and all she had seen in that back was more misery. She'd been so instantly overwhelmed by ancient dread that she'd clapped her hand to her mouth and, so it seemed to her children, spat into it. It had caused those children to catch each other's eyes behind their mother's back, but they said nothing because that was now their habit. They'd watched her grip the back of the pew in front. They'd felt the tension in her body. They'd waited as she fought to find a calming breath in the suffocating air around her. They'd wondered if the sight of the coffin was reminding her of their father, because it was memory of him that most often rattled her nerves. And they'd been right in a way. Marcus Nightingale, faultless though he was in death, had not been entirely so in life, and definitely not where Louisa Worthington had been concerned. Louisa had tried to lure him from his marriage. For that, she was to blame. But hadn't he encouraged Louisa to believe he was tempted? And hadn't that been a repeat of something repellently similar when she and Louisa had been barely out of their teens and Louisa had lured William Mabry from an understanding everyone knew he'd had with her? It might have been long, long ago. They might now be 36, but a knife stuck into the same wound twice leaves a scar so tender it can never be forgotten. No man was safe from Louisa. No man. And now she was blonde, for crying out loud. While the vicar, pious in the pulpit, had been asking the congregation, "How big is a small man, and how small is a big man when it comes to the eye of a needle?" Adelaide had asked herself with more precision, "Why is she here?" What on earth could have induced the bane of her former life to come back to Prospect when all she was returning to was a falling down house and a very bad name? Well, she definitely wouldn't welcome her. Louisa had been dead to Adelaide for years, and she would remain dead, deader than Marcus and the mayor combined. Adelaide, known above all things for the sweetness of her nature, was consigning Louisa to hell when, without warning, Louisa turned in her seat to seek her out and, finding her, had smiled enthusiastically and waved. God help her, Adelaide had waved back. She had smiled and she'd continued smiling even as she'd turned to her children who were transfixed. "That's Mrs. Worthington. I can't stand her. Stop staring, you're in church." 10 rows behind, on the opposite side of the aisle, Pearl Fletcher had watched Adelaide's distress and flinched. She, too, had choked in dismay when, alerted by the secret congregation's low hum of shot and recognition, she'd turned to see Louisa sweep past with such a sense of ownership she might already have been a Maybury. Pearl had clutched the arm of her husband, Joe, who'd shrugged because that was his answer to everything. But dark foreboding had entered her soul as surely as it had entered Adelaide's, and she'd hugged close the beauteous child by her side and held on to her for all she was worth, even though that child had struggled and muttered, "You're crushing my dress, Mother! Stop it!" Even though her three sons, known to all and sundry as A for Abel, B for Benjamin, and C for Christian, sitting next to the beauteous Daisy, were miracles of decorum by comparison. Surely she wasn't the reason Louisa had come back. Surely Louisa wasn't wanting after all these years to acknowledge the baby she'd taken such pains to deny. Louisa had given birth to Daisy in secret, in the small house in Bondi owned by Annie Maguire, who'd raised Pearl from babyhood, attended only by Pearl and Annie. It should have been a moment of great joy, so beautiful was that baby. Annie had handed her to Louisa, but Louisa had passed her right back. She didn't want it, would never want it, and that's what she'd said. She'd rested for an hour, then she'd dressed, gathered her bags, and left. Neither Pearl nor Annie, nor the baby herself, had heard from Louisa in 10 years, and neither Pearl nor Annie had revealed the fate of that baby to anyone other than Joe, who'd become her father. For all Louisa knew, the child had been adopted by a missionary family in New Guinea, so why would she lay claim to her now? This was what Pearl Fletcher, known for her common sense, her nerves of steel, her certainty on all matters, and her smugness with her place in the world, had told herself to calm her thumping heart. The vicar was describing the genius of the station waiting room, and the congregation was shivering because it was freezing, but Pearl could only grapple with the best way to avoid catastrophe, and soon she'd decided. She and Annie and Joe would fight Louisa Worthington to the death. That's how fiercely Pearl loved that child. To the death. But as Reverend Wilmot cried, "Butter! What did butter mean to this great man?" Louisa had beamed in her direction. "Hello," she'd mouthed, and Pearl had mouthed the exact word back and smiled. Maggie Albright, formerly O'Connell, had been neither looked for nor found during that interminable service. It hadn't bothered her. She'd been less concerned with where Louisa was looking than how she was looking. Maggie was seated at the back of the church with her husband Ginger, who now ran their family farm, but had once been the shop boy at Nightingale's, Adelaide's famous food store, which Maggie herself now managed. Missing from that family group were Maggie's brothers, Al and Ed, strapping lads of 20. They had jobs in Sydney and were doing far better than anyone could have hoped for, from wayward orphan boys raised by a sister whose love for them just about triumphed over their refusal to do as she asked. They wouldn't have been remotely fascinated by Mrs. Worthington. It occurred to Maggie that they mightn't even remember her. But she remembered Louisa Worthington with bitterness and resentment for the condescension she'd always shown her. Today, however, her greedy interest was in what Louisa Worthington was wearing, freshly back from London, Paris, New York and Sydney. If Louisa had spotted Maggie as she'd passed within inches of her on the way in, there'd been no friendly wave or enthusiastic beam. "She doesn't recognise me," Maggie had murmured to Ginger, who'd hesitated so long before replying that when he did, his wife was no longer next to him. She'd moved with great agility to claim a seat on the aisle so she'd have an excellent view of Louisa on the way out. That view had been fleeting, but Maggie hadn't wasted a single instant of it. When the coffin paused just ahead of her during Onward Christian Soldiers, she'd noted every detail of Mrs. Worthington's dress, cut on the bias, her shoes, chisel-toed, her hair, her hat, cloche, and the sweet little jacket, bolero, that ended just beneath Mrs. Worthington's heavenly and much fuller-than-remembered bust. She'd noted as well the state of Mrs. Worthington's face and accepted without question that it looked a good 10 years older than her own, because it was a good 10 years older. 8 then. But so much younger than either Mrs. Nightingale's face or Mrs. Fletcher's. But even as Maggie turned her head to see if she could catch Louisa's eye, they were off again. William Maybury had taken his mother by the arm and was leading her from the church, allowing Louisa to follow like an abandoned woman. Serves her right, Maggie told herself. But that wasn't what everyone else was thinking. Adelaide Nightingale, for example, was wondering what life for her would have been like if she'd married William Maybury and not Marcus. What now? The rest of the congregation was asking itself as they filed from the pews. What next?